Hey everyone, welcome back to Talking Success. I'm joined today by none other than Lex Sonokin. I hope I've pronounced that right, Lex. I'm so sorry if I haven't. Sokolin, right? Many of you will probably know Lex from his incredible newsletter that gets sent out daily. I've been a subscriber for a number of years and learned a hell of a lot. And I was just saying before we went live, it's great to finally put a voice and a name to an email address, right? And a newsletter. So Lex, thanks so much for joining. I know you're a crazy busy man. So I really appreciate you taking the time to have a chat with us and specifically our audience, which we've not spoken before, so I don't know a great deal about sort of your experience and interest in emerging markets. But our audience is primarily across Africa. So people working in, you know, digital banking, fintech, payments, digital transformation, but again with a lens and a very much a focus on Africa. And we've had some incredible guests over the last few months from across the world, really, from the US, from the UK, from Asia Pac, and sort of talking to us about what's going on in their markets and where there's some sort of collaboration, or there's some learnings that either we can take from other markets here in Africa, or in fact, what Africa and, you know, given the uniqueness of the fintech sector here and, you know, the sort of true problems it's solving, what other countries can learn from some of the successes that we've had in this part of the world. But before we get into it, Lex, I know there's a lot more behind you and about you than just a newsletter. So I've done my research, but do you want to give a quick intro in terms of your background, kind of how you got into this mad world of fintech and blockchain and AI and even artistry? I understand you're a bit of a keen sort of digital artist as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, and happy to open some of these things up. You know, I feel like my career has been, you know, you're watching a YouTube video and you're starting out on kind of an you're just looking up some sort of recipe, and then you let it go to the next video and it's starting to talk about the manufacturing of the ingredients. And then the next video is like a conspiracy theory about where they come from. And then you end up sort of in like this flat earth YouTube ecosystem. So I feel like that's happened to me. I started out my career pretty traditionally in investment banking and investment management at Lehman Brothers. And so I had that experience of the bankruptcy and the destruction of mature financial systems very early on. And that was very instructive for me, to my experience. I then ended up going into entrepreneurship in 2010 or so, founding a robo-advisor in New York in the US. And that was before, I'd say, both the word robo-advisor and fintech really came about. And for me, fintech is really, there's always been financial technology, but fintech, as we use the word today, is the application of Silicon Valley thinking and sort of the Web2 design pattern on top of the distribution of financial products. And so I built a fintech company. We raised $50 million from some asset managers, ended up selling it to Franklin Templeton. And that was around, for me, I left around 2016, 2017 with this kind of nagging feeling that it wasn't really profound what I was doing. Like it was a great company. And I think digital transformation is important, but it wasn't the large technology platform shift that excited me about things like the mobile web or social networks. And so I spent 3 years in a research firm building out a practice, looking more deeply into certainly the kind of the incremental stuff. So neobanks, paytech, insurtech, but also the larger platform shifts of blockchain, artificial intelligence, and AR, VR. And, you know, for a brief moment, people would call that the metaverse. Yep. I think we're going to call that the metaverse soon enough again, given that today, I think, is another Bitcoin all-time high. You know, but for me, the interest has always been finance. And so it's the economic architecture of the metaverse that I care about. And, you know, in 2017, asking the questions of how how these larger, profound transformations can affect finance was a difficult question. And personally, very interesting. So I ended up going down into all the rabbit holes. The one that was the most actionable at the time was Ethereum, and in particular, computational blockchains, not just sort of the Bitcoin store of value thesis, but the ability to build software and businesses on top of blockchains using their architecture for not just payment processing and commerce, but for let's say the instantiation of the things that the commerce is about. And so in 2019, I joined Consensus, which is one of the larger blockchain company, one of the core technology companies in blockchain. I'll put it that way, the Google of Ethereum, and spent 4 years there doing everything from running decentralized finance product to rebuilding the marketing team to focusing on crypto economics and building a token engineering team and an asset allocation team for the treasury. And so taking very seriously the question of what is an economic future that is anchored on chain look like. And about the final chapter of where I am today is in the summer of 2023, I left to found a venture capital fund called Generative Ventures. And that's what I'm focused on now. It's an early stage fund, and we look at the intersection of Web3, generative AI, and fintech in one. So I'm happy to traverse any of that, because I know it's quite a word salad, but that's where we are.
No, listen, I think very topical and very interesting. As you quite rightly said, you know, Bitcoin, where are we today? The 11th of March, and we've just hit another all-time high, $71,500, I think it is today. So when you're listening to this, it'd be interesting to see what the prices are going for then. But taking sort of crypto aside in terms of a trade and using it as a marketing thing, right? Taking that aside and looking at the utility behind crypto, you mentioned the metaverse, and I'm fascinated around this, Lex. I've been having this conversation with a number of people over the last couple of years. When we're talking about commerce in the metaverse, it's actually quite complicated. From my perspective, it's quite complicated, right? So sovereignty-wise, and if I'm buying a product or I'm buying an NFT or whatever it may be in the metaverse, now obviously different countries are going to want to be able to tax this because, again, looking at sort of financial crime and looking at money laundering, actually you're looking at metaverse going, actually this could be kind of the next stage of how people launder money. How does that get regulated? How do companies who are active in the metaverse, how do they declare their taxes and where do they declare their taxes? And secondly, what do you think there will be a central or a primary currency being used in the metaverse? I know that's a lot of questions all wrapped into one, but what's your view on sort of that compliance side and the regulatory side and looking at financial crime? Do you think there's ways that this is going to be overcome, it's going to be abused?
I think it's actually very super straightforward and not very complicated, but in part, I'm going to give like a pretty naive answer. And so the naive answer is the best money launderers in the world are Deutsche Bank and HSBC. So I think let's start with that and then realize that all of that relative to that, crypto and everything related to it is small potatoes. And if anything, it is far less convenient for the gray market because it is always tracked. All the data is there. And for the right firm like Chainalysis, or I forget the one that MasterCard bought a bit ago, it is trivial to figure out. So again, before sort of the rhetorical question of what about, I think the right motion is to point at who actually does the money laundering And the answer is the most regulated banks. And the second question is, how effective is that regulation? And the answer is extremely ineffective. And then the question of, you know, what's the cost of global compliance, number one, relative to the proceeds that the damages, let's put it that way. And then the second thereafter, what's the cost of the banking oligopoly as a result of fixed costs of compliance, meaning it's very expensive to be compliant. Therefore, you're encouraging an oligopoly in response. And is that what a good market policy is for financial institutions? So, you know, I'm answering this rhetorically because I think it's in part a distraction and is not kind of a profound problem. I mean, there is a profound problem in the sense that it is known that North Korea has hacking groups that are targeted on hacking DeFi protocols, decentralized finance protocols, and extracting capital out of them in order to fund their programs. You know, and that is a sort of a national actor level attack on financial infrastructure. To me, that's akin to the propaganda wars for politics between, you know, Russia and the US. And I think it's a question of nation state action rather than a question of, you know, should we have these particular financial rails? So, you know, in a sense, I am dodging your question, but I just think of it as kind of a non-problem. The second part is, you know, think about the usage of the internet and media, you know, so like people from all over the world have websites that collect emails. In some parts of the world, you need to do GDPR and you need to contort yourself in particular ways to pretend that you're not collecting emails, you know, while really all you're doing is creating friction for onboarding and in effect, you know, injuring the consumer. That's my personal view. But end of the day, like, depending where you are and who you market to, you do have to follow local regulations. But the jurisdiction over any particular commercial action really is this two-sided, the manufacturer of the good and then the purchaser, right? So are you marketing to somebody who is domiciled in some particular geography and then as a manufacturer of something where you domiciled? So none of that changes. We already have this exact issue with the internet today. So in the situation where you have digital assets or digital objects being exchanged, it is much easier to do that in a permissionless way, meaning it's very easy to onboard and offboard, you know, but to the extent that you're going to connect to a local economy, meaning you might be pulling cash into a bank account or, you know, instead of an NFT, you might be connecting a sneaker to your rendered sneaker or whatever, there's going to be a physical location, a physical business. And I think the regular laws apply. There's nothing kind of exceptional about that.
Do you think though that the PSPs of this world, don't need to name them, do you see them, and you're very close to this, again, innovating and looking at how they can accept different forms of cryptocurrencies as payments specifically for the metaverse? Because again, you know, yes, I can go onto the metaverse, I can go onto the dark web, right? Let's be honest. And I can go and buy something and I can send them crypto, right? Wallet to wallet, peer to peer, and it's done. I'm not going through a PSP. If in the world that we perhaps imagine 5-10 years time where we're all sitting with headsets and we are, you know, making purchases online, whether it be for properties or NFTs or whatever it may be, do you think there will be PSPs that are specifically aligned to operating in the metaverse, therefore requiring, you know, KYC and KYB and AML and what have you? Do you see that being something that's going to happen? Do you think it will remain more peer-to-peer based in terms of payments in the metaverse? What's your view?
Yeah, so to just divorce the word metaverse so that, you know, people don't get carried away about the science fiction sort of framing of it, right? Like, let's just say today we already have the metaverse in the sense that you have an economic infrastructure that's based on crypto assets, and then you can buy crypto assets. Just because you're not wearing a headset and living in a video game world doesn't mean you're not primarily in a third space, right? So the way I think about it is, kind of Starbucks is a famous example of a third space. You have the home, you've got the office, and then you have somewhere else you might go. And I think today that somewhere else you might go is Twitter or TikTok or OpenSea, you know, so there is already a third space where you are projecting your digital avatar in the sense that you have some sort of identity that you're projecting into the digital world, and that identity is, that avatar is, has certain behaviors. And to date, most of those behaviors have been, media behaviors, meaning they're there to earn attention and social status and followers and so on, powered by advertising. And the invention of Web3 is to say, you don't have to, these behaviors don't have to be media behaviors. They can be, productive behaviors, in the sense that you can make things, you can have financial interactions, you can have ownership and so on, right? So you can have an internet that is primarily economic rather than attention focused. Attention is just a channel for distribution. The question is distribution of what? And so Web3 gives you an answer to that. It gives you the ability to create digital objects that can be owned, transacted, and so on. So all of that exists, right? You don't need to render it in a Mark Zuckerberg headset in order for it to be true. Okay. So then the follow-on question is, you know, one way to ask it is like, what's your identity there? Is your identity the onerous identity requirements of banks? Like, do you have to bank gate yourself into this? And the answer is super obviously not, in the same way that you don't need to, bank compliance yourself into reading some websites or putting up a blog post. Similarly, you don't need to do that in order to create some good or service and sell it, you know? And I think most people in the space that I'm in see that as like a profound freedom and liberation rather than a safety concern. That said, and this isn't my metaphor, but I think it's apt. You do have this, you know, permissionless or trustless space. And these are words from the industry. And I think for many people in the financial industry, they sound bad. But it's, you know, it's just rhetoric. All it means is, in the same way that you can pull up a website or render a website without having to buy a book that has the website in it, you know, i.e. a permissioned purchase of content versus a permissionless one. In the same way, you can access economic and financial resources in a permissionless way. And generally, that's a net good because you're reducing friction. But this thing is kind of like international waters. Like, everyone can't have jurisdiction over it, right? Or if everyone has jurisdiction over it, then no one has jurisdiction over it. You can't get to agreement. And that's basically what we've seen. So it's the ports that matter. It's not the what exactly happens in the ocean. It's the ports that matter. So if you're trying to go from the land of science fiction and, you know, anarchist freedom, anarchist techno freedom utopia, you're trying to go from those waters into the waters of particular sovereignty of a country by availing yourself to the law of that country or the wallets of the people that live in that country. So you're trying to sell them something, or you're trying to pull money out of the permissionless sea into their bank accounts. That's where the gates are, you know? And I think that's the most, that's in some sense, that's an aspirational framing, but that's the framing I align with. You know, I do think that, it's possible to put up these gates and to, at the moment of docking at the port, figure out if you want this activity in your jurisdiction or not. Because again, every single action on chain is trackable. So it's, trivial to say, okay, you know, okay, you've touched applications that we find risky. You know, it's likely that because you've touched these mixers, you know, or you've done transactions in this protocol, therefore we find your activity suspicious, and we don't want you to transact or to offshore in our port. And that's possible to do. That is not difficult. It's not, you know, imaginary. It's been done by the blockchain analysis companies now for probably 5 years. So,
money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Sorry, Lex, I was just, before you finish, I was just going to ask, is this where traditional finance and decentralized finance, so DeFi and TradFi, is that where there is some convergence? Is that where there is going to be a degree of interoperability, if that's even the right word? Can they both coexist? Is one going to outrule the other? What's your view on that?
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to that, a couple of answers. The first answer is, you know, why? Why does it matter? So there's two ways of looking at this stuff. The first is, one is to think about it as in traditional financial services, you have the manufacturing of financial products, and then you have the distribution of financial products. And then in between the factory and the store, you have, you know, supply chain. And supply chains, I think, are not where the value is created. If anything, you do cost savings there, or you lengthen it, you shorten it, you put protections around it. But supply chain is maybe a source of advantage, but it's not a source of innovation. And I don't find it particularly relevant for like understanding where things are going. So that leaves, you know, either the core manufacturing, you know, who is the hedge fund, who is the bank depository, who is the underwriter of the loan or the insurance policy, and so on, or the distribution side. You know, what brokerage do you sit in? What's the bank branch? What's the mobile app that you're downloading? And so, you know, traditional finance has this pretty much figured out. Fintech has taken the human approach and, you know, killed it and replaced it with the superior digital approach. I think that trend is pretty much over. You know, there's still sort of residual gyrations where traditional financial products are now being, you know, turned into APIs and embedded in developer experiences. But again, that's just a different distribution channel. What decentralized finance has done is, rather than challenge distribution, it has challenged manufacturing. So decentralized finance allows anyone to be a financial engineer and to manufacture any financial product that they want. Whether that is a banking-like product or a lending-like product or an exchange-like product and so on. So it's a bit counterintuitive because we're kind of used to financial apps and thinking of mobile apps as the form factor, where in fact it's the manufacturing of financial product that is being digitized. That's the competition. So, you know, you can have different permutations now. You can have traditional financial products that are distributed to Web3 users and crypto customers. That, for example, is what a stablecoin is, right? So mm-hmm. the digital dollar as manufactured by Circle is it's not a novel financial instrument. It's the dollar. It's a bank deposit. And there's about 60 billion of it. And, you know, Circle makes a 5% float on that. And it's a pretty good business. It's a cryptocurrency, but it's a traditional financial product on chain. The other way is taking a decentralized financial product. Let's just take Bitcoin as an example of that, and selling it through traditional financial distribution. So the Bitcoin ETF, you know, and in this way, that is very symbiotic to brokers and asset managers. It's great for BlackRock. It's great for Fidelity and so on to sell stuff to people. That's their job, to put the things in the box and then sell the box. So I think when you take it through that lens, there's definitely overlap. And especially when there's revenue generation, it becomes attractive to traditional companies, the traditional finance companies. I think when you get in the world of when you get in the world of cost reduction and trying to shove blockchain into core banking systems or, you know, CSDs and settlement systems or payment rails, and when you try to layer them on as if they were, you know, a technology solution that can scotch tape over 50 other technology solutions that you have in the bank, that's a failure mode. And, you know, we've seen that as an enterprise failure mode now for probably 5 years or so. I think what will happen is eventually the old world will just, how do I put it? It'll continue to run, but things in the new world will reach a new audience, and that's where the growth will be. And financial institutions like Coinbase will, it'll become more and more obvious the way in which they outperform financial companies that don't avail themselves to the new rails. I think, yeah.
And you mentioned a few moments ago about sort of the new world, the traditional banks or the incumbent banks, DeFi, Coinbase. I think generally, certainly in this part of the world, there's a lot of distrust when it comes to financial services companies, whether it be a bank, whether it be payments companies, whether it be lending companies, whatever it may be, whether they are a household name, as in they've been around for 200 years and they're a bank, or whether they're a fintech that's had venture funding from you know, Silicon Valley. There is an element of distrust, which is why cash is so difficult in this part of the world to displace. When we're talking about decentralized financial services, DeFi, how do you think DeFi operators, so organizations that are building these DeFi products, are going to build trust with consumers who are, by their very nature, conservative and would prefer to have the cash in their hand and in their back pocket where they can touch and feel it and smell it, than actually now they're being told that you've got a decentralized, as in, you know, the government doesn't have you know, ownership over it, the bank doesn't, and it's some fintech that's popped up from, you know, no one's ever heard of before. And you can tailor and build your own sort of financial instruments and your own financial products. Now, that's great if we're talking to people who are in the industry, who are very well educated, who understand, you know, the different types of products they can build. But to the mass market, again, I'm talking about this part of the world, even Latin America as well, very similar markets. How do you even go about that? I mean, this is, you know, to use your words a bit earlier on, we were talking about the metaverse. I mean, this is sci-fi to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, and I think the answer is you just don't have to, because there are natural adoption curves over time that'll you know, either spread or not. One of the, and especially, you know, with DeFi protocols, there's often not really a team that's trying to cause any sort of adoption. You know, these are just big open source projects that people contribute to create shared infrastructure. So, you know, you don't have the incentives of like an Uber where you have to grow at all costs and it's really important to go and attract customers. It's simply not there. It's usually the other way, meaning People demand these services because they find them and because they're interesting to them in their revolutionary characteristics, like censorship resistance, like being unseizable, like providing a currency that is anti-inflationary, to give a more narrow answer, I think there's two use cases that for the Global South have repeatedly come up. One is just the dollar. So this is the easiest way of accessing the dollar. Mm-hmm. And, whether it's in Venezuela or Argentina or in Africa or in the Philippines, the remittance corridors are starting to use stable coins. Yep. For money movement. So most people don't need to know about what's inside of the car and how the engine works. They just know that they're buying the dollar and this is the digital version thereof. That's it. And so does the digital dollar need to be sold to this population? No, you don't, because you will be pulled into it through the economics of the gray market will pay you much worse for dollar cash than it will for the digital dollar. And so people are selecting into that. In the same way, people can select into Bitcoin. But I think it'll take a little bit longer for Bitcoin to have a stronger brand than the dollar, for whether or not that's to be deserved or not. So that's one direction. And I think that's, again, drives global adoption without any particular marketing effort. The other thing that I see is, if people know they can make money doing jobs in Web3, even if they're silly jobs, they will do it. So there was a moment in 2021 where if you were playing a particular crypto game called Axie Infinity in the Philippines, you would earn 4 times more than the national average wage. So if you were farming that, you were, your daily behavior was to log in and do activities in this game, you would earn 4 times as much as you would doing quote unquote real work. And there are many examples of that. That's Axie Infinity is one example. Another example is a fitness application called Steppen, I think that came out of Australia, where the tracking of physical activity was rewarded in tokens in such a way as to be competitive with the wages that are earned in low-income countries. And so again, you don't need some sort of customer acquisition rationale about shoving people into a payments app. Rather, you have the opposite dynamics, which is why these things are, so viral. Is it persistent? Is it real, et cetera? These questions are useful to ask, but are relevant to the lived experience of the people who actually do it. Because people just do it, for a year and a half, they just did it. That's the arbitrage. So it doesn't matter from an analytical point of view what you think, because it is just happening. So I think between the dollar and the economic opportunity, you are going to suck in a lot of populations that for whom this opens up kind of new possibilities.
I guess there's an element, like you said, you don't really care if we're on a DeFi protocol. For all you care is I'm doing something and I'm earning out of it. Right now, again, using your car analogy, do I know how, the gears work in my car? No, I don't. Do I care? No, I don't. I just know that it works, right? Do I know how, I know nothing about cars, right? But, I don't really care, because it gets me, it does what it says on the tin. And the outcome is that I get to my place safe and, in a bit of luxury. And that's it, right? That's all I care about. I do want to touch on one other thing as well, because we've spoken about the metaverse, we've spoken about DeFi, we've spoken about TradeFi, we've spoken about crypto, cross-border payments, using crypto as utility. Now, there's obviously one other element that we've not discussed yet, which is AI. And I'm not talking about ChatGPT, and I'm not talking about DALL-E and things like that. But where it comes into fintech and financial services specifically, how do you see, because I know you're a futurist, Lex, so where do you see, if we wind the clock forward, I don't know whether you can 5 years, I mean, 5 years, when you asked this question 10 years ago, you were able to give a pretty clear answer. Now, it's like, well, in 5 months' time, where do you think AI is going to be? But let's try and look a little bit more forward than that, maybe 2 or 3 years' time. When we're talking about AI specifically within financial services, specifically within fintech, how do you see that evolving? Where do you think the opportunities are for organizations and for individuals who are interested in perhaps joining this entrepreneurial trail and looking at building something? Where could they focus? Where do you think the market will go?
Sure. So I think it helps to disambiguate what AI means to whom. You know, I think for me, the useful dividing lines are, number one, around machine learning, and number two, around generative AI. And so machine learning is AI that's fairly well adopted inside of finance already. And, you know, all these things are just math, end of the day. Machine learning is sophisticated statistics. Generative AI is sophisticated statistics. The human brain is sophisticated statistics. So it's kind of the core pattern of the universe. But it is just math. You know, and we put these anthropomorphizing labels on it to think about robots and so on. But it is just math and technology. So machine learning is a way of decisioning. It's a way of taking complicated data and then coming to the next decision, you know. And the toy example would be teaching a piece of software, a neural network, the ability to tell apart a cat from a dog, you know. So the decision is, having run the neural network that has been trained on past data, is the next image that you see a cat or a dog? And in 2015, I think ImageNet became better than a person at machine vision, you know, more broadly than just a cat versus a dog, but being able to identify objects and so on. And that's when we got all the excitement about self-driving cars and doing it inside a video. When you switch over to finance, the examples would be lending underwriting. So being able to take historic data and make the next decision on a particular exposure to risk, whether it's, you know, whatever data you're using about a person. Same stuff in capital markets, usually on a very short time scale. So when you're deciding in the next couple of seconds what positions to take or what arbitrage to do, you might end up using lots of data in order to do that. Same thing within insurance underwriting. Same thing within payments fraud detection. Yep. You know, so real time payments, deciding if the person you're interacting with is a real person or not, and these are kind of things that replicate human intuition, human decision making. And I think this theme is fairly well integrated into finance at this point. I wouldn't say it's been a failure, but it's been non-disruptive because most of the banks have been able to retain their data. And as a result of that, capture the value of these technologies and force the machine learning finance companies into the shape of a services business, therefore defanging them. So they're non-threatening. Whereas if you look at big tech, none of these are services businesses. They are large product businesses. you know, everybody's in the thrall of their distribution and so on. You know, when you're interacting with a TikTok feed, you are teaching a machine learning algorithm what you like. In finance, when you're interacting with a bank, nobody's learning anything. You know, and that's largely because the bank is still somehow getting away with retaining their data and not doing anything useful with it. Now, the step where we are, generative artificial intelligence, is the opposite of that analogy. So instead of I see a thing and I have a decision, it's the opposite, where you start with I have a concept and then I hallucinate the thing. You know, and so people say generative AI hallucinates when it makes mistakes, but in fact it hallucinates everything it does is a hallucination. And there is a deeper, profound truth in that, which is everything that you and I experience is also hallucination, because that's how the mind works. Nothing is actually real. It's all just a rendering that our mind makes for ourselves. And so generative AI is doing that statistically in order to create, broadly speaking, digital objects. And those digital objects can be content, they can be code, it can be voices, it can be image representations of people, it can be video representations, it can be the rendering of 3D models and worlds, and so on and so forth. And the quality of these renderings in whatever media they are, at this point, are kind of at a level of a junior white collar employee. Like not a very senior one, but like better than most interns. Mm-hmm. And so this next wave is less about plugging into the existing workflow and adding a little bit of like decision juice into places, and much more about the productive capacity of software systems to do the labor that people used to do. So for me, generative AI is an economic transformation where you can have GDP, you can have growth and economic output that is made by machine systems, where you have basically, they're not free because it costs quite a bit of money to run the machine brain. And that's why NVIDIA is now a $3 trillion company. And their infrastructure is very in high demand. But the sort of the economic transformation is that we all have access to machine workers that can do our bidding, and they can be deployed in any context, whether that's within finance, customer support, and the bank, or whether that's on marketing and distribution, telling stories and being brokers of particular financial assets, or whether that's doing investment analysis and summarizing earnings calls and putting that into equity research reports and doing correlations and math and so on, or whether that's writing software that does financial actions, all of those things. And so I think the impact is much more profound than sort of like a tweaking within the infrastructure of financial companies, but rather a reshuffling of who does the work and the figuring out the source of economic growth. You know, so in my venture fund, I spent a lot of time looking at things like AI agents. You know, so if you have employees that are machine brains, looking at the payment processing around AI agents. So if you have machine to machine systems, how do they communicate? How do they pay each other? What are their wallets? Looking at the ownership of these systems. If I have digital avatars that replicate my image and voice and do things on my behalf, how do I own it? Do I really want that to sit with a big tech company? Am I comfortable with the custody of my data? Inside of these organizations, you know, and trying to figure out, I think for me, trying to figure out what's the path to a GDP economic output where, you know, 5 or 10% of GDP is coming from these systems. And again, that's financial firms are, they should be consequent to that. Financial firms are a result. They're not a precedent. They don't, finance doesn't do anything other than solve backwards for the economy that's been created. You know, you need banks because businesses need loans or because people need deposits. You don't need, it's not the other way around. You know, if you didn't have businesses and you didn't have people who needed the spending, then you wouldn't need banks. And so I think the generative AI theme is very much precedent to the financial industry. And so if we can figure out how these things become productive, then all the finance stuff will follow.
You mentioned the agents. This is something I've been fascinated with for the last 6 or 7 months. And I'm not a coder, I'm not a programmer at all, but I've always wanted to be. And I've been using some of these tools, these agent tools, to try and build, you know, some basic software. It's mind-blowing at the moment, right? And I'm not saying, you know, you're going to go and build an enterprise, you know, system using this today, but you can certainly see if this is what's capable now, it has the capability of doing something I would deem quite complicated as a complete novice in the world of programming and software engineering, to what it could be in, you know, a few years' time. Again, we have this conversation a lot, and I think we've had it a lot over the last 12 months. You know, is AI coming in to replace humans in terms of some of the jobs that people do? And I firmly believe the answer is yes. I also think it will create other jobs that people haven't heard of before, prompt engineering being one. You know, you asked someone 3 years ago what a prompt engineer was, and probably be someone on a film studio somewhere, right, holding up a banner. But, you know, this is taking a whole different sort of direction. And with, I think it was Klarna, was it 2 weeks ago? You probably read this or saw this. They used a chatbot for their customer service, and it did the work of 700 people in something like 4 hours or something crazy. I mean, it was just madness. So do I think there's going to be, you know, disruption when it comes to workforce? Yes, I do. But, you know, where there's disruption, there's always opportunity. Your view on that from a human perspective and looking at the labor markets, where do you think that's going to go?
And so it's too deep a question. You know, I can riff on it a little bit because I think it goes to, it just goes to philosophy, really. Because I also believe that, you know, there's just a level of labor and competence that is now available to everybody for $10 a month. It's just there. Like, yeah. And the competence will only become higher because that's what software does. It doesn't get dumber. It only gets better. And so if you're feeling safe, if anyone is feeling safe, they shouldn't, because over time, just like the chip becoming more powerful in terms of processing, intelligence is going to be more competent across industries, right? So whether that's finance or healthcare or content and writing and entertainment and so on, that's just going to be deeper. So in my view, trying to push back on that is a waste of time because it's already happened. You can't put that back in the box. Even if you put back the centralized version of these companies, the open source version is going to blossom, right? So in the same way that you couldn't stop Napster or Bitcoin, you're not going to stop AI from being a participant in the labor market. I think that for low-skilled knowledge work, this is devastating.
Yeah.
Because it's just not going to be an option for people anymore. So, and eventually high-skilled knowledge work as well. I think you're going to have massive asymmetries in terms of people who are able to use this technology to amplify themselves by a factor of 100 or 1,000. And then the people who lose their roles because they're no longer doing the amplification, right? So if you can pay somebody $30,000 a year versus a robot $100 a year, most people will pick the robot. An example, I forget who I'm stealing this from, but there's an example about horses and cars, both horses and cars offer transportation. Mm-hmm. Like people, horses are animals, and one of the pushbacks against cars in the early days was like, well, like I have a relationship with my horse, like I feed it, I love it, it loves me. Like we look each other in the eye and like we're together in it, we're a team. And obviously the robot won profoundly, And so similarly, you might have a relationship with your colleagues and enjoy chatting with them and learning about their families, but these things are not what you're buying. To the extent that the car offers better transportation, AI is going to offer better labor. And that's that. That's the end of it. So I think the philosophy is, what are the political solutions that we have to that? How do we feel about lots of people no longer having access to work? They don't deserve the work because they don't do a good enough job. The software does a better job, and therefore they shouldn't have that job. However, you're at the same time creating a tragedy for what is likely going to be millions of people, and you're robbing them of dignity and purpose and passion. Then there are questions around universal basic income and robot taxes and things of that nature. I'm deeply pessimistic about any solution to this problem because I think the political systems we have, there's no evidence that they can deal with small problems, let alone big ones. So, I think my only recommendation to people is to be on the right side of how the cookie crumbles, which means to have lots of curiosity for the new technology and to jump on the ship before it lifts off. I'm not in a position of advocating philosophical answers to this stuff or political answers, because I think it's the coordination to deal with it is really difficult. And the regulation that's going to be coming out is mostly nonsense, because the folks who are trying to write rules about this thing, they're not technologists and they don't understand what the thing is. Kind of similar to politicians that were yelling at Mark Zuckerberg about not policing individual posts on Facebook, don't understand that there's literally billions of posts and no amount of human attention can ever keep up with these machine scale systems.
Regulation is one thing, but I think academics and academia needs to catch up with this quickly. I was having a conversation with family members the other day, and my girlfriend's nephew was given a task to do, and I think my girlfriend said to him, well, just use ChatGPT, right? As long as you prompt it correctly and you understand the output. Anyway, his grandmother was not very happy at that response. And then came the debate about actually the school saying don't use ChatGPT or don't use generative AI. And the argument on one side is, of course, they shouldn't because it's done as cheating. But it's inevitable that this is going to take over. So if children aren't being taught today how to correctly prompt and to understand the responses that you're getting from an answer, it's all very well and getting a poem or getting a script. If you don't understand the context behind it, if you don't understand why it's come up with that, or if I change my prompt slightly, I get a different output. And this whole debate sort of took off and it got quite heated at some point, right?
Yeah,
Trying to cool down. But I think education is a big thing. I know in China at the age of 7, children are taught now part of the curriculum to learn AI. Now we're looking at ready workforces. Compare that to other parts of the world. It's foresight, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to learn your multiplication tables, but it's not a particularly necessary skill when you've got a calculator. And so you can have lots of feelings about a calculator, but your calculator feelings are helpful to nobody. And so in the same way, you know, generative AI, what is it? It is, you take the full body of human knowledge and you compress it into a particular graph. And then using natural language, you're able to navigate that space and get representations of all human knowledge in any form that you choose to massage. You're accessing the brain of all humanity. And so if it's very different, or let's say it's a misunderstanding to say that you need to, well, the way to learn AI is really with a pencil. You should learn how to do the math behind a neural network. And then once you do that, you can scale it up to, you know, understanding a transformer model using code. And then once you build your transformer model, maybe then you can prompt. It's ridiculous. I mean, the people who design a game and the players of the game are not the same people. And so, you know, the skill that I think you want to teach most people is how to be the players of the game. Some people will continue to do the advanced work of designing it and extracting, you know, knowledge at scale and packaging it into these foundational models. But again, the Pandora's box is already open.
I think it is. And again, you know, do you know how a generative AI platform with vector database and all that, how that's built? Well, if you're into computer science, absolutely. But if you're not, why do you need to know that? Going back to your point, do I know how the engine works in my car? Haven't a clue. But it gets me to where I want to get to. Lex, on that note, I'm going to say a big thank you for your time and for sharing your insights. I've learned loads. I do this podcast for selfish reasons because I just learned so much. But if people want to find you, if they've not subscribed to your newsletter, your blog, I'm going to put some links at the bottom here. But is LinkedIn your biggest channel, or are you on other channels as well? Because I only follow you on LinkedIn.
Sure. You can get the newsletter at fintechblueprint.com. And you can check out genventures.xyz for our investing themes. And then you can find me at Lex Sokolin either on LinkedIn or on Twitter.
Wonderful. Lex, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And have a good week, given it's Monday.
My pleasure. Cheers.
All the best. Take care.